This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness this week, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with me Steve Riles. We're going to talk about his book, Drunk with Wonder, which is going to talk about the spiritual epiphany that happened to him in his life. How are you, Steve?
I'm doing fine. How about yourself, Eva?
I'm good, thanks. We were just talking about your past 10 days. You've had a tough 10 days, haven't you?
It's been, it's been very challenging. My wife, her sister Rita, was killed in a head-on collision on Valentine's Day. And I just returned literally 2 hours ago from being down with their family in Southern California and doing the service on Friday and being with the family and being with people with broken hearts.
Yeah, no. It's a hard, you know, it's a part of life, and it's expected, but not everyone it happens to us.
We don't want it to, do we?
No.
As we get older, and I'm 58, I just see this inevitability of friends and family beginning to pass. The longer we live, the more of that's going to happen. And
yeah, it gets a little close. It makes you start really looking at how you feel about it.
It certainly can. I watch people. I've had a number of people pass on in the last few years in our circle, and I notice some people do what I used to do, which is jump in a bottle.
Yeah.
I'm celebrating 7 years of sobriety basically today.
Really?
And I've watched people this weekend who, you know, just ran for the wild turkey.
Yeah.
And I love them, and I understand. I have a lot of compassion. If it was my wife or my sister, instead of a sister-in-law, I would find it even more challenging in many ways to cope with this flood of emotions. But that's what I wrote my book about, Drunk with Wonder, and that's what I am counsel people on and support people in doing, which is feeling their feelings and having their emotions and learning some emotional literacy rather than finding some way to go into the denial and distract themselves.
I'm curious, is your wife awake?
Is my wife
awake?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So she understands, and did she use that this week?
Oh, absolutely. She's a healer. She uses emotional freedom technique,
mm-hmm.
And she has clients all over the country. And she works by phone and in person, and in fact, she was working with her sister's husband this afternoon.
Good.
And she's a rock. I mean, she's an incredibly powerful person. We know this stuff. We can recite, as they say, chapter and verse, and yet when it comes to our own hearts, they break too.
Yeah.
Because we're awake doesn't mean our hearts don't break when someone we love passes on.
You know, and sometimes, you know, just the physics of it, to whatever degree you're able to experience bliss,
uh-huh.
You can feel that same degree of misery. If you let that guard down of being in the moment, you can feel that same degree of misery because we feel things a little bit more intensely.
Well, you know, Eva, that's a really good point you make, because what I'm convinced of is that before we assign a label to the energy, it's simply energy. It's
mm-hmm.
a very, very intense rush. And then in our culture, when there's an intense rush of energy from losing someone we love, we are taught that that's called grief, and that's called sadness, and it's awful, and it's terrible, and it's all of these things we're taught to call it, and we're taught to fear it, we're taught to avoid it. But you're absolutely correct. If we are simply willing to be fully present in the moment and feel this very intense rush of energy without labeling it as bad or wrong,
mm-hmm.
it is a very different experience.
Right. It's the conditioning behind it that messes us up.
Yes, I believe that's so.
So, tell me, you were on heavy drugs and alcohol, and practically homeless.
Oh, I was homeless.
How did you get there?
I wasn't practically homeless. I was literally living on the street 40
really?
Years ago.
How many?
40.
How'd you get there?
Well, yeah, like many kids growing up in the 50s and 60s, I rebelled against, you know, essentially against a very tough, discipline-oriented father who thought that he could beat the hell out of you and that that was going to do you good and you'd do better in life if you were, you know, were beat up a lot, emotionally and physically abused. That's what happened to him.
Yeah.
He didn't know any different, so mm-hmm. I rebelled against that, and I wound up, you know, the first time I smoked a joint, I thought, oh, boy, I feel better than I've ever felt in my life. Just because I wasn't feeling any pain and I wasn't feeling any rage in the moment and so on and so forth. So I mistook, you know, I thought that was the way to go. I thought consuming, ingesting chemicals and alcohol, you know, drugs and alcohol was the way to help me to cope with an uncomfortable life. And from the time I smoked my first joint to the time I started shooting drugs was about 18 months. And about the time I started shooting drugs, that became my life. That became my entire focus. I was 17. I was basically a runaway in Haight-Ashbury in the spring of 1967 is when that was. And I, you know, I learned how to panhandle, and I learned how to pose for the tourists. And I did basically anything I could, like any junkie type of person will tell you, this is the lifestyle you go into. And I was doing it because I would, in essence, I was trying to kill myself. I just wasn't willing to pull a trigger or
yeah.
walk in front of a train or something to, I was just doing it a little slower. And I did that for about a year. And I had the epiphany I had was when one of my best friends, Carl Happy, in right around the time that Martin Luther King was shot and killed, he came to visit me, and he found me just completely strung out on methadrine, speed, and he, and I can go into more detail if you want, but the point is that he really strongly put me in a place where I could see that I was really killing myself, and as part of that process that I went through, I really had my first out-of-body experience, and I saw myself very, very clearly, emaciated, dirty, you know, smelly, and so weak from drug use and lack of food that I couldn't hardly move. I was lying on my bed. I was you know, kind of bumping along the ceiling like a helium balloon, and I had that epiphany of, okay, you're going to die, you're going to live. And I chose to live, obviously. And I came down off of that, and the next day I just walked out of that crash pad I was staying in, and I called my folks, and I went home.
Now, when did you get your knowledge of oneness and all of that?
Well, you know,
did it come then, or was it later?
That was one of my first glimpses of it. I mean, that was an awakening. You see, what happened was I moved back home and started to get cleaned up, and I started going to therapist, and within 3 weeks of that experience with my friend helping me, on May 1st of 1968, he was killed in a motorcycle accident. And that deeply threw me for a loop. And I was despondent again, and that's when I really picked up the bottle because I couldn't deal with my feelings there. But you see, that summer, my friend Carl started visiting me in my dreams. And that was really, in many ways, the start of my spiritual journey because I didn't understand how that could be. You know, I know he was dead, yet he visited me not just once, but a dozen times probably. I had such vivid...
How do you know that it wasn't just a dream?
Well, he told me it wasn't, And because he physically looked different, he looked older, he had never been able to grow a beard, and he had grown a beard, and he told me very specific things about what I had been going through, my sadness and my kind of losing it, and that he told me very encouraging things about spirit and about that he had been called to do something else. He was on another assignment, so to speak. That was the way he talked about it. And to not, feel my feelings, but that he was better than fine. And that there was a really big universe out there. And that the sooner I was willing to start looking at that, the sooner I would have a more fulfilling life. So that's, I went back to school, and 4 years later, I had my degree from UC Berkeley, and went on with, and started, the woman I met at the time, we found The Handbook to Higher Consciousness by Ken Keyes, and we took off in our spiritual journey, and it was in 1991 that a friend helped me bring through my higher self in a very clear, conscious way with a name. I mean, it's basically a channel, mm-hmm. With a name, and he calls himself Arandaho, and I'm celebrating almost, 17 years ago.
And did personality stay with you, or did it eventually fade into just you?
He primarily has we call it integration,
mm-hmm.
and the integration really began to happen after I stopped drinking.
Mm-hmm.
As long as I was drinking, there was more of a sense of separation, if you will, even though that mm-hmm. was an illusion. And after I quit drinking, because one of the first things he ever told me, and I've got a bunch of this stuff still on tape, Eva. One of the first things he ever told me is that when I grew up, I was essentially going to become him. And that it was my process of awakening and accepting the truth of who I really was and who we all really are, which are infinitely precious sparks of God Goddess.
And I guess what he really meant was you were going to become that energy that he presented.
Yes, that I was going to awaken into the fullness of who I am, and that as I did that, this sense that I had to go into a trance and kind of Steve personality would have to essentially leave.
Yeah.
And Arandaho would come through.
Yeah, that's kind of the way it was for me too, and eventually it kind of went away because it, one day it actually said, this is Seth, and I'm leaving now, and it'll just be you. For really, that's all there is. You weren't secure in being who you can be yourself, so you needed somebody else to label.
So that's you had a very similar experience, and I want you to know I read a whole lot of the Seth material back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
The Nature of Personal Reality was a
turning point for me too.
Oversoul 7. Those were really amazingly powerful books for me.
So did it change the way you were suddenly or over some time?
It took a while. This part of me, this party animal guy, he really fought it tooth and nail. Yeah, he didn't want to own. I mean, I imagine you've realized this too, Eva, that there's a place where that part of us that doesn't want to take responsibility for everything that has ever happened to us wants to blame it on somebody else.
Yeah, it's more comfortable to take that victim mode.
Exactly.
Somebody else's fault this happened to me. Somebody else's fault I'm depressed. Somebody else's fault that these bad things happened.
Exactly. If only you were different, I'd be fine.
Right.
That one. Yeah. Well, I spent a long time running that story. And that's part of what I talk about in Drunk with Wonder is awakening out of that. And really, one of my goals is to compassionately talk to people, because I understand how challenging it is to just stop all of the victim dance and stop blaming my father, you know, the government, the church, school, you know, fill in the blank, and just say, you know, I was doing the best I could at the time.
And if somebody tried to tell you, would you have thought that's ridiculous?
Absolutely.
So,
how about you?
I'm about to tell you what. I was just like you. I was passionate. I had to tell everybody. I had to fix everybody.
Yeah.
And now I realize that it's just gradients of consciousness, and they're going to think what they think regardless of what I say.
Absolutely. That's it.
You know, there's nothing I can do. So I've gotten to the point where I don't preach it anymore. I just go, okay, when somebody says something.
But it's good that you're doing your show, Infinite Consciousness.
I don't have any choice, really.
I hear that. That's, in a way, I didn't have any choice with writing my book.
Yeah, oh, I know that feeling, too. I had to do it. And now I look back at it, and I think how ridiculous it is telling a story about Seth, an entity, telling me this stuff. But, you know, I had to present in some way that I would understand it.
And I want to just offer, you know, a compassion for that part of you that needed to do it that way. You know, it was part of the journey.
Mm-hmm.
It's really part of what got you here today. And when we see it like that, I think we can come to more appreciate all of the choices we made, even though sometimes we go, oh, my gosh, I really did that?
Yeah. Did your family think you were crazy, or was it too slow of a change for them to think that?
They didn't say they thought I was crazy to my face. I actually, my father and my mother actually sat down and had a session with the Rondo.
Interesting.
About 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't say a lot about it, but they, you know, they never stopped loving me, never stopped supporting me. My mom loves my book, and of course she would, right? She's one of my biggest fans, and has always been a very big supporter of me in making choices, you know, making healthy choices. And she knows that my heart is in the right place, so to speak. So she's comfortable with my doing these things.
How does it change the way you live your life?
I live off the grid now. I mean, I've made choices that come right down to, okay, you know, it reminds me of a book by Jack Kornfeld, who's a Buddhist teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called After the Ecstasy, the Laundry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about, okay, so you wake up. Okay, now what? You know, the laundry still needs to be done. The dishes still need to be done. Got to do dinner. I got to do firewood for the winter. I got to take care of my granddaughter. I got to love my wife. I got to take care of myself. You know, I got to do what I can to create the world of my dreams, the world that I vision, which is free from war, is a sustainable future, is a green future, an environmentally conscious world where nobody's hungry and nobody's shooting at anybody else. That's my dream. It's a big dream. And
everything's a dream, don't you think?
Pardon me?
It's all a dream.
Well, you, of course. Of course. And so I know that, and I don't let, or I do my best not to let some of the stories that are going on in the world keep me from feeling love and feeling the joy and bliss that's available in every moment when we choose it.
When you first had this, did you have some physical sensations that were different? Did you
when
feel
I
like
first
you were walking on air for a while?
Absolutely.
Did you feel a buzzing feeling?
Oh, sure. There was an intense, I liken it because that was what I was used to. I likened it to getting high.
Mm-hmm.
Without using anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was real, and with a lot of clarity. So I felt when I would do a session with a Rondo, you know, and I would, you know, I learned how to hypnotize myself and do all that stuff and, induce this state where Rondo would come through. When I had finished with that, I always felt like I'd been meditating for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I felt like $1 million.
How did it, do you have children?
I don't. I have stepchildren.
Okay.
And one of my stepchildren is now married and has, and we have a 2-year-old granddaughter who lives close and I adore. And is one of the biggest thrills of my life. When I say, "Oh wow, I'm so glad I didn't keep drinking so that I could have this experience of having
awesome.
A granddaughter," you know.
That's wonderful. So what about, I was going to ask you, how did it change the way you raised your children from the time you were growing up? But
well, I did help raise my former wife, Quanah. I helped raise her son, Mike, and her daughter, Kim. And I made very different choices, even though, looking back on it now, I don't think I was a great parent. But I didn't beat them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't hit them. I could have been more loving, absolutely. But I did make some changes. I didn't carry on that tradition of the belt and the yardstick and that kind of profound public humiliation and so on. That was a hallmark of what both my parents had been, the way my parents had been raised.
Let's talk about something. It's getting on a little bit into it, but I want to know what you think about free will. Do you think we have free will?
Absolutely. I think I so strongly believe in free will that I believe that all of us make a conscious choice between lives to incarnate in the bodies we incarnate in, with the parents we have, and to have all of the opportunities for the lessons that we do. And come hang out with friends. And essentially, I believe we're all God, that it's all God, mm-hmm. that there's nothing here but God. Choosing to live out a life, a great story, much like one of my favorite metaphors is as though we were characters on the stage. I mean, Shakespeare talked about this 500 years ago.
All right. Let me ask you another. I'm gonna ask you your questions first, see what you think, then I'm gonna ask you some things that may cause some rejection of some of those beliefs. I don't know yet. We'll see. Do you think we live in a holographic environment?
I believe that the universe is holographic. Yes, it's a yes. That every part is represented in the whole is represented in each particle.
Okay. Do you think that it's set in stone, that it's pre-chosen before we get here?
I do not.
So you think that it manifests second by second?
I think that we come into being, we come into having our life, and that we have the parents we have and the siblings we have, and we come up through our lives through being babies, and we have the experiences we have, and we often choose experiences that make it look like it's a fear-based universe,
mm-hmm.
and that we are still able to, depending on the choices we make in the moment, that's where free will comes in, to remember who we really are.
Okay.
And to awaken. I mean, it's kind of like, If we were, we're God, see? So we're really good at playing pretend.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
Yeah.
So, let me think for a second. I don't know where it's at.
But I don't think we're puppets following a script that we can't deviate from.
I guess the reason I'm asking this, there's a big confusion out in the world whether there's free will or not.
Uh-huh.
And if we had, and I'm asking you this as a mystic, as you're being a mystic, if we had complete free will, why is there the starvation going on? Obviously, those people don't want to be in starvation.
What I believe about that is, and I'll take this down, because I've looked at this a great deal, Eva. God, as us, chose to put on a great passion play with a cast of billions over tens of thousands of years. And to have a great passion play requires things like duality or the appearance of duality. If we didn't have the appearance of duality, we couldn't have a story of any kind. We couldn't have a context. That makes sense, right?
Yeah, because you can't know what there is unless you know what there's not.
Right. Or what? Yeah, you can't know what night means unless you have day.
Mm-hmm.
You can't know
illusion of day.
Right. And we can't know what happiness feels like we don't know that as a distinct feeling unless we also know what sadness feels like.
I guess the reason I ask that question is I've gotten to the point where I used to think we had complete free will. And I ask everybody this question, so don't feel picked on, okay?
Okay.
But I've gotten to the point where I think that we have free will to make, to react rather than observe, but that we don't have complete free will of what our life is, or it would radically change whenever we thought an intense thought that was positive. Does that make sense? So I don't think that we can necessarily change the actor's role that we're in, but we can change how we react to it.
Well, I think that's the key. I really do. There is what I call the isness of the world, the situation, the isness of our parents, the isness of our, you know, our community, and so on. And then what we really have control over, I believe, is how we are with that isness.
Yes.
The story we tell ourselves,
right,
is where the free will comes in.
Right.
And yet depending on how present you're willing to be in the moment and how much you're willing to own, that's where I believe the free will comes in.
Yeah, because we have free will to place intention.
I mean, I was running along in my life, and I was in a marriage that wasn't great, but it wasn't, you know, in many ways it wasn't that bad, certainly better than a lot of people's, and I had lots of material things and so on and so forth, and I saw myself, you know, this is what this house is going to be. And then I met my wife, and I felt deeply in love and rose, you know, powerfully in love, and had a connection at the soul level that I had really forgotten was possible in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, with as much love and courtesy and kindness as I could, I started making choices. I walked away from the business I was a co-owner of. I walked away from two homes. I walked away from this marriage 20 years. And I moved into this rural community to be with the woman I'm with today. And I think about that often. That talk about making a choice that is so far off of the track I was going.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is free will. Many of us don't. You know, we build up inertia. I call it inertia. We're running down that track, and it could feel like it's impossible to change it. But it's only impossible if that's the story we keep telling ourselves.
Were you a seeker before this happened?
Absolutely.
So would you agree that there was nothing you could do to make this happen, that it just happened because it was time? Or disagree?
That's a fascinating question.
You couldn't meditate for an hour and guarantee that you would have the experience, or you couldn't, if you were doing nothing, you were high on a bed, you couldn't make it happen. It just happened all by itself.
Well, you know, I started meditating formally, transcendental meditation, in 1980, and my first experience like this with the rendezvous didn't happen until 91. And it happened in the context of, I had a dream that was the coolest, most amazing dream I'd ever had in my life. And it was the only time I ever remember waking up from a dream laughing with pure joy. And I was so fascinated by that dream that I went to see a friend of mine who had become a hypnotherapist. I didn't even know if I could be hypnotized. And so I was just following this, if you will, intuition.
Mm-hmm.
And unbeknownst to me, her name's Marilyn Gordon, and she's a hypnotherapist in Oakland, California, has a thriving practice and a school and so on. She channels a being named Samuel. She didn't tell me that. She just put me into a trance, and her, Samuel, told her to ask me if there was someone inside of me, some part of me, who wanted to speak, who had anything to say. And a rendezvous came through for the first time.
Interesting.
And it was all on tape. And I wouldn't have believed, my conscious Steve wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't heard it on tape. So did I consciously choose that? No. But did I follow my intuition, and did it lead me there unerringly? My higher self? Absolutely.
What about the blissness that came? When it happened to me, I couldn't have made it happen no matter how hard I tried. I didn't even know it existed.
I quite agree. It's out of our knowing. It's out of our conscious minds, out of our ego-based personality. It's out of that world. You can't do something new. You can't get something new or create something new by doing things the old way. So what we did, what I think you did and what I believe that I did, was we found some way to relax the reins, to release our hold on our story enough so that this higher energy could become, that we could become aware of it.
Did you come away with any kind of heightened awareness or a heightened ability?
I heightened intuition.
How do you get it?
How do I get
heightened? How do you receive it to interpret it? Is it like a psychic? Do you hear? Do you feel? Do you
know? It's very much a feeling and a knowing. I get images and I get feelings that I then translate into words.
Mm-hmm.
When I get really tuned in to somebody, I can often support them in going deeper into issues for them that are troubling them that they're not conscious of or consciously aware of or don't, et cetera, et cetera.
You told me earlier today that you had some experience with your sister-in-law. What happened since she died?
Well, one of the things, she died on Valentine's Day, and that was a Thursday afternoon that we found out. By Saturday morning, I had my wife on a plane. And I'm also a graphic designer and writer and editor, and I have a lot of stuff to do here on our homestead. So I put her on a plane, and I came back here, and as I say, we have 40 acres, and I do a lot of work with a chainsaw and timber and all that stuff. So I was, I don't know what you call it back there, but here we call it running a burn pile. And I was, we had a number of trees that had come down in a big storm, and so I was burning some of the branches from that. And I was sitting out that Saturday night, the same day I took my wife to the airport, and I was just sitting by the coals of this fire. And it was a quiet, calm night with a bright moon. And we have a seasonal stream here, and I was listening to the stream and listening to the frogs and just being outdoors. It's one of my favorite things in the world. It's like a cathedral. And all of a sudden, I was kind of thinking about what had happened and feeling into it. And all of a sudden, Rita, her face, and she had a booming, raucous laugh. She was full of life. And I just saw her face, and I saw her grin, just kind of etched into the night sky. And I heard her laugh. And I heard her say, don't take this too seriously, Steve. Remember, we're all God here. I'm fine. I'm good. You just, take care of Joanne and take care of my mama and help Gary. That was her husband. But she said, you know it's all good. So, just enjoy the night and know I'm with you and know I'm with you all.
Mm-hmm.
And, the tears came and it was a very, very deep emotional feeling, and I appreciated it a lot. And I actually told that story. People had a chance to get up and talk about Rita during the service on Friday, and I was able to get up and tell that story.
I understand. I really do. So, tell me some stories that you've had to go through. I know you've gone through some. Have you? Had, since it happened, most of the people that have epiphanies it's like a pendulum. They have some kind of epiphany, and it'll stay there for a couple of years, and it'll swing back, and they have another dark night of the soul. Have you had to go through that?
I certainly have.
What happened? How long did it take?
Well, the truth is I've been through them more than once.
About every 2 years or so?
Oh, for me, they often happen around friends or family members dying.
Mm-hmm.
A dear, dear friend of mine, Robert, somebody who was a workshop leader and a singer-songwriter, and someone who had reached me in a workshop. He was leading a workshop called Quantum Shift back in, gosh, 15 years ago, just about now, February 93. And I was, you know, I knew I was drinking to excess then, and I was bringing a rondo through, but it was really hard for Steve to listen to a rondo because Steve, you know, really struggled. He loved drinking and he loved partying, and he thought if he gave those things up, he wasn't going to have any fun anymore.
Yeah.
And there's a place where we have to be willing, in a way, to die to our old story.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that we physically die. All the masters talk about this. But we have to let go of our old stories. I had to let go of my story that I was a drinker, that I was a party guy, you know, that I was a cool guy because I got stoned, I got drunk, you know, that whole story. I had to let go of the story that in order to be good company, or in order to be able to be animated and, you know, and friendly and all those kinds of things, social, I had to lubricate it with alcohol. And in a way, part of me died. And I had to be willing to let that part of me go, to let that story go. I had to be willing to grieve, to let myself feel all of the feelings around letting go of that, all of that stuff. And I have a lot of compassion for how challenging people can find doing that to be. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I was going to ask you, you know, a lot of people say, well, what button do you push to make that happen? Well, there's not a button, but do you find that it's really controlling mind and not thinking, but rather being and observing?
I absolutely, I language it as when we awaken, and as we awaken, to the extent that we awaken, what we're awakening to is that there is a presence that is not our thoughts, which means it's not our mind, and which means it's not our story. You know, I'm Steve, I'm this age, I'm weigh this much, I've, you know, had this life, I've been married to these people, I've done these things, I wrote this book. That's all a story of who this man in this body is in this lifetime. And those are all just stories. And who I really am is none of those things. And so when I choose to stand in the truth of who I really am, this vast consciousness, which is not any different or any more than everybody has the opportunity to step into. I don't want to in any way intimate to your listeners that I think I'm any grand poobah. I am no different than anybody else. I'm just more conscious of what's possible.
Aware of what's there all the time that you didn't recognize.
Exactly. When I started really getting into this, Eva, I was able to go through, I thought it several different times in my life, and was able to say, oh, a rondo took over then. Or, oh, you know, that consciousness, that saved me from that wreck. You know, I could never figure out, for example, one time when I hadn't been driving very long, I was with my mom. I came around this corner in our big old station wagon way too fast. And my mom screamed, and for a split second, we thought sure that we were going to have an accident. And somehow, We didn't. And we never could explain it. And finally, you know, when I started talking with Arondo and working with him, and I looked at, you know, there was a time in, it's actually Valentine's night of 1974, I was in an apartment that caught fire. And the fire marshal started questioning me because he thought I deliberately set the fire for insurance. He said, there's no way you should be alive. And then I said, but I don't have any insurance. And he went, oh.
Oh, wow.
Well, you better thank your lucky stars, because you shouldn't be here. And something woke me up. Because I'd been, you know, I'd had a few beers, and smoked a couple of joints, and, you know.
You were out.
I was flat out on my waterbed, my brand new waterbed. I'd just graduated from Berkeley the year before. And I was lying face up. My arms were outstretched. I was, before I was wearing contacts, I still had my glasses on. And I kind of came to and went, oh, I passed out again, you know. I should get up and turn the light out and get into bed, you know. And then, you know, it's kind of like different senses kicked in.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing was I opened my eyes and I looked at the light in the ceiling. And I, boy, that's funny. Why does that look so, look like there was fog up there? And then my ears kicked in, and I heard this, you know, this.
Oh,
and I thought, boy, what in the world? And, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, all the senses kicked in, and I jumped up and raced into the living room, and the entire wall was on fire.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, so, et cetera, et cetera. So, in a, you know, we were right in Oakland, and the fire department was there in 4 minutes, and they still had to, you know, the power pole outside the living room window had caught fire, and the aluminum side, you know, the aluminum frames around the windows was melting into the street below, and they had to shovel the living room into the street. You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Do you notice synchronicities differently now?
What I would say to that question, Eva, is that I notice synchronicities. It's not that I notice them differently. It's that I notice them when I didn't used to.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Have you had some interesting ones?
Oh, God. I've had so many interesting, you know, and I'm part of the Science of Mind,
mm-hmm.
Ernest Holmes, you know,
mm-hmm.
religious science and all that, and I'm training. I'm just finishing up my second year of training for a ministry. My wife's a ministerial graduate, and that's part of our spiritual path as well, and we do something called treatment, something called demonstration. And it's really a way to, as far as I'm concerned, it's a way to intentionally focus energy to create a desired result.
Mm-hmm.
And the demonstration is that result. So for me, it's about paying attention to an intuition and then following up on it. So for example, I was with some friends and we were going to go to an event where four people who had near-death experiences were going to speak. So I'd had dinner with these friends, and we went in two separate cars, and this other person went ahead of us. And we didn't realize it was going to be so well attended. So we start up the street towards the Congregational Church up in Tiburon in Marin County, Northern California. And we see our friend has parked. And on the street is completely choked with cars and people walking, and everybody's parked, and there was not a parking space. And the person I was with, I said, you know, let's just create the perfect parking space. Let's just keep going. And we drove all the way up the hill, and there was nothing. And I'm beginning to think, oh, you know, well, I guess maybe this isn't going to work. And so I went up to the top to this cul-de-sac, thinking I was going to turn around. And just as I got there, this young guy walked out of the house across the street from the church, got in the vehicle, and drove off. And I was right behind him, and I pulled into the parking space. So that's and it happens, that kind of stuff happens so often, we kind of laugh about it
mm-hmm.
at this point in our lives, that kind of synchrony.
Why do you think people... before waking up, don't notice the synchronicities that are always there?
because I believe because we're trained not to. Literally, we're trained. Do you know the term entrained?
Uh-huh.
We're entrained. I believe that we are taught to live unconscious, to live in a story. Because when we're not conscious, that's when the TV can hypnotize us. And the ads can hypnotize us. And the whole consumer world can hypnotize us.
Now, I noticed in your book, you talked about how you live now, you know, how you get energy to run your house.
Uh-huh.
Did all of that come about by waking up? That's with a lot of people, you know, suddenly the earth is important when it wasn't before.
I am so convinced, Eva, that one of the surest signs of an awakening soul is that the whole idea of littering or not recycling, you know, not taking care of the earth, just becomes unthinkable.
Yeah, and treating about how you treat other people, does that change?
Absolutely. When, as we awaken, we recognize that it's all God, then everyone is God. Everyone.
Uh-huh.
And so, as we are able to become present with that, people who used to push our buttons, we can start to look at them as special messengers, special angels who have come to hold up a mirror to us, and that's often a spouse or a child,
mm-hmm.
for example, or a brother or sister or mom or dad, to show us the parts of us that we most don't want to own. For healing.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
My boyfriend and I go to counseling.
Uh-huh.
Couples counseling.
Uh-huh.
Because he says, I want to make sure whoever I marry this time, I don't get somebody that's going to turn on me in an instant.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, you know, and to the therapist, because I said, you don't understand, I'm different. I'm not better or worse, but I'm different.
Uh-huh.
And the mere thought of doing something to someone else to piss them off intentionally scares me to death because I understand what's going to come around and slap me in the face when I do it. Do you agree with that? Doesn't it change the way that you view the world and how you respond to people and you can't help it?
Absolutely. And, you know, my wife and I actually met in a workshop. And by the way, I did tell my wife, I hope she's listening, I told her specifically that you thought you might be able to bring Rita through and she might have something to say.
Yeah,
I
can't promise, but
oh, I understand.
If she wants to, I can hear it.
So I just wanted to put that out there, and she said she would try to listen. So I just, if you're listening, Joanne, I love you, and hope you're enjoying this. And before we end our time together, Eva, I just wanted to put that out there.
I don't know that it'll happen on the air, but
okay.
Because I have to actually stop what I'm doing and get intensely focused.
Oh, I can appreciate that.
You know, and then there would be this huge thing of dead time on the air.
Okay.
But she can call me tomorrow evening or some other evening that she wants her on the weekend.
Okay.
Happy to do that.
I'll put that out there to her. In any event, I'm sorry, I lost track.
You were telling me that you met her in a workshop.
Yeah, we actually met in a workshop, and we've done many couples workshops, and we've assisted at those workshops and led small groups, and you know, it's her fourth marriage and my third, and so we didn't think we would get married again, and we've been together 12 years, into our 13th year, and we have gotten in fights, and we get tired, and we forget, and we can be very small and very petty, and that's our human side.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've learned is that our spiritual side is able to forgive and have compassion for that part of us. And we are willing to come together and say, you know, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I blew it. You know, I don't, this is not the way I want to live. I want to have a loving, open, close relationship that stands the test of time. And, you know, this is like what we've just been through. That's, you know, it's easy when you're happy and it's all fresh and new and you don't have a big story, you know, a lot of history together. But when you have a family member pass away, you know, a couple of years ago my dad passed away and Joanne was really there for me. And now her sister's passed away. And it's so important for me to show up for her.
Yeah,
it's just part of what we do when we make a commitment. It's the way we talk about this, Eva, is that, and this is something that we were taught years ago, is the idea that many people kind of leave their back door open. You know, I'm in this relationship, and I'm here, but if you treat me bad or if I don't like what's going on, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And that's called having the back door open.
I like that phrase.
And so if we commit to closing the back door, then we commit to figuring out a way together, as long as we're both still committed to it. If it takes counseling, if it takes reading another book together, if it takes going away for the weekend, if it takes having a date night, whatever it, just stopping our work, putting the phone down or turning it off, and just sitting down and opening our hearts, being vulnerable, getting back on the same side. And so far, we've been successful in doing that.
I think that's, you put it wonderfully, actually.
Thanks.
Good job. We got about 8 minutes left, and I want to make sure you get to talk about whatever you want to talk about without my questions.
Well, I want people to know that my book, Drunk with Wonder, Awakening to the God Within, is available on Amazon or on my drunkwithwonder.com website, and they can order it toll-free and all that good stuff. I can also be reached via email on the website, the Drunk with Wonder website. Happy to ask questions and talk with people. I want people to know that my book is about awakening to the truth of who we really are, with a specific emphasis on emotional literacy. You see, most of us wind up getting wounded emotionally at some time in our lives. And there is very little training in our culture about how to responsibly and honorably and respectfully feel our emotions. And so what I've learned is that what's holding most of us back, I believe, from awakening to who we really are is our stories that we're not good enough. And these stories get locked into cellular memory, really literally locked into our cells with adrenaline. Because when we're scared, when something really heavy happens, we get a flood of adrenaline. And we're all addicted to adrenaline. We're all hooked on it. It's the ultimate rush. You look around and you see ways that we get an adrenaline rush everywhere. You know, one of my favorite ways to get adrenaline for years was to drive too fast.
Was the what?
Drive too fast.
Oh.
Be a speed demon on the road, you know. How fast can I drive without getting caught? And without killing myself or somebody else. And I've slowed it down a little bit over the years.
Let me ask you something. How well can you deal with those people that pull out in front of you now?
Okay. This is actually something I love talking about. Where I'm at with my driving, when I am a conscious driver, nobody pulls out in front of me. Nobody cuts me off. And the reason why they don't is because I'm watching traffic. And I can tell when somebody's in a hurry. It's not really hard to tell. And I can see that they're wanting to get into a certain place. And if I don't contest that space, if I'm not arguing, oh, no, this is mine, you can't get in there, and I let them go, they're not cutting in front of me.
Right.
So I don't get excited because I see what they want to do, and I can either run my ego and run my, you know, bad boy trip, or I can let that go and just be love, go and you know, and gift them with getting on with where they need to go.
Right. It's not because they're trying to do something to you.
Right. They don't know who I am. They're not after me. They don't, you know, it's, I can tell the difference, you know, because I've run the same roads in the Bay Area. I've lived here for 36 years, 37 years, since I moved up to Berkeley in 71 to go to UC Berkeley as a junior. And I've been in the same roads where I just, everybody was cutting me off. And everybody was, you know, wanted to get me. And I've driven that same road, the same time of day, with the same traffic, and had none of that happen. And I realized that the variable was me.
Yeah.
Not anybody else.
Beautiful story, Steve.
Thank you.
All right. One more time. Tell us where we can find you one more time.
Yes. My book is called Drunk with Wonder, Awakening to the God Within. My website is Drunk with Wonder, D-R-U-N-K, with wonder.com. And you can order toll-free through my website, or there's a phone number. In fact, let me give you the phone number. It's 800-247-6553. 800-247-6553. I have excerpts from the book. My book is also available on iTunes and Audible.com as an audiobook.
Oh, that's nice.
And people all over the world who've downloaded it and really love it.
Do you have an email in case somebody wants to send a question?
Sure, and it's Steve, S-T-E-V-E, at drunkwithwonder.com.
Thanks for coming on, Steve. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Eva, thanks. I really appreciate all your questions. I feel a deep resonance with you, and
thanks.
I appreciate the work you're doing in the world.
Well, come back sometime.
I'd love to be
if
on
you pass through Atlanta, call me.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
All righty, dear. Good night.
Good night.